welcome to Tuned to Yesterday, broadcasting programs from radio's golden years. I'm your host, Mark Levonier. Coming up in this hour, true history, albeit strange stories from the past. Later on, it's the Origin of Superstition program, then a seance in an effort to communicate with the dead magician Harry Houdini. But first, it's Strange as It Seems, episode 32 in the syndicated series from 1935.
Makers of X-Lax present Strange as It Seems. These strange but true stories are brought to you twice each week by X-Lax, the original chocolated laxative which was first offered to America 29 years ago. Little tablets, delightful to take, which have changed the customs of a nation. The Human Horse. The thin line between sanity and insanity is often hard to find. In the case of George Asher of Joplin, Missouri, no one could ever tell what caused his strange obsession of being a human horse. It is 1927 in Joplin. Michael, a farmer, enters a harness shop.
Mr. Brown, you got that bridle ready for me?
Just a second, Mr. Michael. I'll go back in the repair room and see.
All right.
Hey, where's the harness man?
Huh?
Where's the harness man?
Oh, he'll be right back.
Who? Who'll be you? I never seen you before. Hey, my name's Asher.
My name's Michael. I'm new here. I just bought a farm about 5 miles from here.
Oh, got any work for me?
Work? What kind of work?
Ooh, hauling, plowing, anything like that.
Oh, no thanks. I've got horses.
Oh, I bet they ain't no better than I am.
Better than you are? What are you talking about?
Oh, you don't know me? Oh, I'm the best horse in town.
Yeah! Oh, I see. Well, you see, I... Oh, here you are, Mr. Brown.
Here's a bridle.
Oh, say there, Brown. I gotta hurry. Have you got my collar?
I'll be with you in just a minute, Asher.
Oh, I can't wait. Now, give me my collar. I'm going to the hauling contest.
Oh, all right. Here it is.
Oh, hey, let me try it on now. Oh, now that's right. Fits down snug on my shoulders. Oh, that's fine. Thanks. Add that to my bill. If I win the hauling contest, I can pay right up for all of you. Hey, say, if you should happen to go to the contest, Mr. Michael, be sure and vote for me.
Is that fellow crazy?
Oh, that's old George Asher, the human horse.
What?
He's harmless. Everybody in Joplin knows him.
You know, I thought any minute he'd bite me. He's the wildest looking feller I ever saw. With that long white mane of his.
He's an odd one. You know, he eats nothing but hay and oats.
He does?
Yeah.
Say, shouldn't he be locked up?
Oh, all he is sort of a nuisance. Mm. Just like this afternoon, he went ahead and organized that hauling contest. Pestered everybody to death about it. Then he enters it himself.
Is that so?
He'll raise the devil if we don't give him a first prize. Probably haul off and kick somebody.
Well, maybe you'd better give it to him, just to keep him happy,
you know. Oh, we always do. That's the only way the poor old fella ever gets enough money to pay his bills.
Well, by golly, I'm going to that hauling contest. I wouldn't miss it for anything.
Strange as it seems, George Asher of Joplin, Missouri, actually did think of himself as a human horse. The poor old fellow died in 1928, penniless, as he had been in life. What strange quirk in his brain ever started him on his weird obsession? The bottle that went round the horn. Santa Monica, California, 1924, on the beach.
What are you doing, Phyllis? I'm writing a note, Mother. I'm going to put it in this bottle.
Oh, why?
I'm going to throw it into the ocean, like the pirates used to do.
Very well, dear. It certainly won't do any harm.
It might go all the way to Catalina Island, mightn't it?
Perhaps.
There. I'm putting the paper inside the bottle. Now I put the cork into the bottle. Watch, Mother. Look, there it goes. See, it's bobbing around. Ooh, won't it be fun to see what happens? I wonder if I'll ever see that note again.
It is 8 years later in 1932. William Staniland and a girl are walking idly along the beach in Tampa, Florida.
Say, look, I almost walked on a bottle. It's half buried in the sand.
Oh, pull it out, Bill. It might have a message in it. Edgar Allan Poe wrote a story about a message in a bottle.
Okay. Wait till I wash it off. There is a piece of paper in there.
Bill, what does it say? Read it out loud.
Who finds this bottle, please write to me. Phyllis Dondeville, 507 North Curtis Avenue, Alhambra, California.
California?
Say, just think, all the way from there. This bottle was thrown into the water at Santa Monica, California, 1924.
It's the writing of a child. She probably meant Santa Monica. She just misspelled it.
Well, I'll be darned. I'll send her the note tonight. Will she be surprised?
Won't she?
Say, I wonder where that bottle has been. Why, it might have been anywhere.
Where had the bottle traveled? Had it gone through the Panama Canal, or more possibly, had it gone all the way around the Horn, to be picked up by the Gulf Stream and carried through the warm waters of the Caribbean? What narrow escapes had it had? How did it ever find its way down the Pacific coast, past Mexico, past the Isthmus of Panama, Peru, Chile, on miraculously through the gale-swept waters around the Horn, the despair of many a famous navigator? Then up the Atlantic, past the mouth of the mighty Amazon, past Devil's Island and the old haunts of pirates of the Spanish Main, until it finally came to rest in the sands of Florida. Strange as it seems, a bottle thrown into the ocean at Santa Monica, California, traveled a mysterious course over 20,000 miles of ocean to Tampa, Florida. The city laid out as a trick. They say the streets of Boston were laid out by cows as they wandered to and from Boston Common in the old days before the Revolution. Other cities can claim equally interesting beginnings, but Yuma, Arizona is one of the few cities to be originally planned as a trick. It is 1853. Charles D. Poston, a mining engineer, has been on an exploring trip into what is now the state of Arizona. He and his party of 15 Americans and Mexicans are now returning to California. They finally reach a military post on the shore of the Colorado River. Since they must cross the Colorado, Mr. Poston goes ahead and talks business with a Mr. Jager, who runs a ferry boat across the river.
Oh, boy. Hello there, Mr. Jager. They tell me you'll ferry us across to California. How about it?
Well, I'll take anybody across who pays me the money, I guess.
Well, what do you want?
Well, how many of you are there?
Oh, about 15.
15, eh? Well, I'll charge you $25 for that.
$25? Say, is that the best you can do?
Yep, 25 nor nothing.
Well, I'll go back and ask them if they can raise the money. Get up.
I'll ferry you all over pronto, at the stone that I get the cash in hand.
Stubborn old fool. I bet the whole bunch of us won't have that much money. Get up now. Get along.
Well, what do you say?
Well, boys, he says he'll take us across the river for $25. How much have we got?
I ain't gonna send.
I can give you a dollar.
How about a hunk of salt pork on account?
I'll give him a Joshua tree.
Well, as far as I can see, we can't scare up more than $10. Is that right?
Yeah, I think so. Hey, I've got an idea.
Yeah?
Let's fool the old fella.
Huh?
Suppose we make camp here and say we're going to lay out of town. Now, I've got my surveying instruments. We can look professional, and I'll bet we'll get the old fella's interest right off.
Well, that's a good
How about
idea.
It?
Well, I tell you, we'll make camp now and talk it over more later. You never can tell. You know, it might work. Psst, look out. Here comes old man Jager. Better get the boys to working.
Yeah. Hey there. Those stakes are out of surveying
line.
Right,
come on
now. Hey, what's going on here? I've been a-watching you fellas for the last day or so. Are you going to build here?
Oh, good morning, Mr. Jager. Yes, we are laying out plans for a city.
That's so.
Poston, yes? Take a look at this map, will you?
Sure will, Ehrenberg. Hmm. Yeah. Hey, looks fine. What's that?
Oh, that's the plan for the steam ferry building.
Hey, what's that you say? Steam ferry?
Oh, yes. The plans include a ferry across the river.
Well, say, you ain't selling any lots yet, are you?
Well, now, it all depends on what we're offered.
Well, I sort of thought maybe we could swap something. You know, you give me 2 or 3 lots, and I'd ferry you across the river free.
2 or 3 lots? Oh, you're crazy, Jager.
Well, maybe only 2.
Well, what do you say, Ehrenberg?
Well, let me see. I don't know. 2 whole lots.
I'll tell you, Jager, I'll give you 1 choice lot right down by the river. If you'll guarantee to get us across by nightfall.
Well, a choice one now, mind you.
Why, of course. Mr. Jager, you have the honor of being the first citizen to own a lot in,
Colorado City.
Yeah, Colorado City. Put her there, number 1 citizen of Colorado City.
Strange as it seems, this was the beginning of Yuma, Arizona. Started as a trick, it developed from Colorado City, a town of imaginary lots, into one of the principal cities of the Southwest. Who was the famous actor who played Death too well? He had played the same role hundreds of times before, but this time he acted so wonderfully that he... But listen in to our next broadcast. You will also meet the strange man who solved his own crimes. You have just heard Strange as It Seems by John Hicks, directed by Cyril Armbrister. Table salt is composed of 2 poisons.
Strange as It Seems, on Tuned to Yesterday, the 32nd episode in a nearly 80-part series produced by CBS in 1935. We move on now on Tuned to Yesterday with a broadcast of the Origin of Superstition program, number 19, released in 1933.
Superstition. Superstition, a god, a false god who rules by fear. I demand a worship from poor and rich alike, from the weak and from the strong. My victims are many. My slaves are legion. You who scoff and disbelieve, listen to this story.
Silence! You will please come to order. This is a session extraordinary of the Supreme Court, held this day of our Lord at the grave of the late deceased Henry Byron at Calvary Cemetery. You will come to order. Justice Peck, presiding.
The petition before the court states that the disinherited son of the late Henry Byron would exhume the body of his father. Mr. Byron, you may state your reason.
It's my belief that my father never signed the will that disinherited me. The thumbprint alongside the signature on the will is not his.
As your sister and the daughter of the deceased, I protest. The thumbprint on the will was that of my father. I saw him accidentally spill the ink that caused the print.
Your Honor, there is $100,000 at stake. The body must be disinterred. The fingerprint taken. There should be no doubt existing.
I still object. Disaster will follow if my father's body is disturbed.
My sister is gripped in the throes of a violent superstition. A throwback from the Dark Ages.
Call it what you will. Thou shalt not disturb the dead.
Rubbish. Superstition. My claim is just. Let the grave diggers proceed. It's beginning to rain.
Yes, it rains. Tears from heaven. Perhaps a benediction on the dead.
Superstition.
A protest from the gods.
Judge, may I request? Give the order for exhumation.
Wait. I'll gladly give up the money. Please do not disturb the body.
It's not the money, it's vindication. He never intended to disinherit me. Let the earth be removed.
My son, perhaps your sister is right. Death may stalk in the wake of the disturbed dead.
Again I say, superstition. Surely the Supreme Court is above such distorted belief.
You're impulsive, impetuous, inviting enterprises that involve danger and daring. Before I give my decision, let me take you back to the career of a young man, Lord Cameron, who challenged the power of death, ignored the superstition involved with the opening of the tomb of an Egyptian king. He paid with his life.
I remember the case, Your Honor. You were a member of the party, I believe.
Yes. It was at Luxor, Egypt. Lord Cameron had been warned by many not to attempt the opening of the tomb. It seems as yesterday. I can hear him now as he laughed at all our advice.
My dear friend Peck, it is absurd to ask me to give up this venture.
But you are practically violating the dead, Lord Cameron.
I am contributing to science, unveiling the mystery of the ages.
It is written, thou shalt not disturb the dead.
Superstition. Let the caravan proceed. Camel boy, advance.
You will rue it. Mark my words.
Are you coming along? Will you brave the death you predict for me?
I suppose so. But may the Lord attend us.
Look, the workers have removed the earth from the main door leading to the tomb. Let's hurry.
Hi! Hi!
Your explorative and adventurous nature leads to your death?
Stop sounding the funeral knell. There's work to be done. Ah, here we are. Hassan, my faithful, the workers have not been idle.
The entranceway has been cleared. There is nothing left to do but force the sealed stone.
It's not too late, Lord Cameron. Let us be content to decipher the hieroglyphics on the terrace of the tomb. Let the dead rest.
What? Stop now? On the threshold of amazing discoveries? You must be mad. Give me that hammer.
Yes, sire.
Dig. Dig, Hassan. Close to the base of the stone.
Great Scott! The slab is yielding.
Soon we will know the secrets of the empire that ruled this entire continent.
There. The slab door is removed, my lord.
The tomb is open. The tomb is open. Success.
Marvelous. That will make you famous, my lord.
Come, let us enter. Hassan, Hamoudi, come.
My lord, I cannot go in. I am afraid. It is dark. I am afraid.
Afraid? Afraid of what? The dead? Fear the living, not the dead. Come.
He is trembling, poor fellow. He fears not the dead, but the blasphemous act of desecration.
Superstition. Silly rubbish. Come, Hamoudi, hand me the trowel. I'll go in alone.
I'll proceed. I'll follow.
Bring the light. Ah, that's better. Don't touch a thing. It may crumble to dust. Judge, here lies before you The history of 4,000 years.
What is that other room?
Leading to the main tomb of the king. I want to open that door.
It is covered with inscriptions. How do you intend to get those writings out of here?
We use wet blotting paper, laid on the stone. Beaten in gently with a small wooden hammer, then lifted carefully off and dried.
You decipher them here?
No. I'll ship them back to Britain to be deciphered while I continue the field work. Stand back, Judge. The door is opening.
For the last time, I ask you to desist. Why risk your life to stuff the British Museum with relics?
I'm going in the tomb and defy the superstitions.
A storm threatens. The gods are angry. Come away, my lord.
Or I'm leaving. I'll wait outside.
Cowards! I'm determined to gaze upon the wonders of the past.
I'm sorry for my master.
No good will come of this.
Hassan! Hamoudi! Judge Peck! I have seen. I have seen.
You're trembling, my lord.
What have you seen, my lord?
How pale you are, Lord Cameron.
I have seen the mummified body of the king. Jewels, golden chariots, magnificent images studded with precious stones, pagan gods inlaid with lapis lazuli.
There. You're ill, my lord, burning with fever. What has happened, my lord?
Oh, something I inhaled as I entered the tomb. It fairly choked me. I'll be all right. Hassan.
Yes, my lord.
Close the tomb. Leave a guard. Hamoudi.
Yes, my lord.
Remain outside here until the British consul arrives. Judge Peck, help me. I am weak. Take me back to the hotel.
Come. Camel boy.
Aye, aye.
Oh, my chest is tightening. Help me, Judge.
You're very ill, my lord.
Oh, stay with me, Judge. Take me back to England. I want to see my family. Something tells me I am very ill. Take me back to England.
There, my lord. Safe on board ship, you'll soon be home.
Home. It is such a sweet word. Where is the music playing?
In the dining salon. Too bad that you're too weak to go to dinner.
I am weak, old friend. Slowly sinking.
I warned you not to defy the superstitions.
Oh, gladly I give my life if I have made history.
You're too young to die, even though you contribute to science.
When I tore the wrapped shroud from the mummified king, a hot breath of gas came from it. I must have inhaled it.
Perhaps medical science will restore you.
I'm afraid not, old friend. I'm afraid not. I remember now, right above the tomb door was a plaque. Words in ancient hieroglyphics. Words which I have heard you speak, my friend.
Words that I have spoken? What were they?
Prophetic words. Words of truth. Thou shalt not disturb the dead.
And Lord Cameron died in my arms.
A victim of his own rashness, his defiance.
And now, Mr. Byron, has my story impressed you? Do you still persist in disturbing the dead?
Let the dead rest in peace. I withdraw the action.
Bless you, brother. The money shall be yours. The dead be undisturbed, and peace of mind be ours.
But, Judge, tell me, how come the superstition concerning the raising of the dead?
It was known long before the pagan Greeks placed their dead in caskets, before savages hung their dead in trees, before India hurled their bodies into the Ganges River, long before Egypt mummified their departed ones. It came from the lips of the creator of you and I and all things. He said, "Thou shalt not disturb the dead."
The Origin of Superstition program on Tuned to Yesterday, a broadcast from 1933. This is an hour of true history on Tuned to Yesterday. I'm your host, Mark Levonier. Next, one of the truly fascinating pieces of audio from radio's golden age, where on the 10th anniversary of magician Harry Houdini's death at the Knickerbocker Hotel in Hollywood, his wife Bess, or Beatrice, held a seance to try to communicate with him. Magician George Boston provides the frame for this classic recording from October 31st, 1936.
Houdini, the greatest showman that ever walked this earth, died October 31st, 1926. Prior to his death, he was seeking out and exposing fraudulent spirit mediums. He boasted that there was nothing that a spirit medium could produce by way of alleged psychic phenomena that he could not reproduce by trickery. Despite this, he took no chances. He and his wife, the late Beatrice Houdini, resolved between them that, whichever one died before the other, that one would try to contact the survivor. They further agreed upon a secret code. This was decided upon to prevent fraudulent mediums or magicians from claiming that they were able to contact either one of the Houdinis. It was further agreed that the survivor would use every type of conceivable seance to contact the deceased. That, once each year, on the anniversary of the death, the survivor would hold a small gathering of friends so that some message might possibly be heard. All attempts were to be discontinued after 10 years. Houdini died first. His widow did not succumb until 1942. For 9 years after Harry Houdini's death, she tried to reach him. Once she seemed to believe that Arthur Ford, the celebrated spirit medium, had actually reached her husband. Later, she decided she had been mistaken, that Mr. Ford had not received the real code message. There were, during those years, almost daily reports of Houdini's spirit visiting mediums all over the world, but not a single instance could actually be proven. It is notable, however, that Houdini definitely did not contact the one living person he had loved most, his wife. Thus it went till October 31st, 1936. This was the 10th anniversary of Harry Houdini's death. After this date, Mrs. Houdini was to stop searching. The 10th seance was to be the final one. In charge of arrangements was the late Dr. Edward Saint, an old-time showman and Mrs. Houdini's business advisor. Dr. Saint decided the affair should achieve epic proportion and proceeded accordingly. The roof of the Knickerbocker Hotel in Hollywood, California, was rented for the occasion. Now, the Knickerbocker is just about one block from the intersection of Hollywood and Vine, the movie capital's most fabulous streets. A bleacher-like seating arrangement was built, which could accommodate about 300 people, and fully this many were invited by engraved invitations. Sound equipment and a special lighting system was installed. Seats for the inner circle were arranged directly in front of the bleachers. As early as 7 o'clock in the evening, the invited guests began to assemble. People from all walks of life, but chiefly magicians, spiritualists, newspaper men, and others who had special interest in the affair. Up there on that roof, it was uncommonly cold. The sky above was clear and bright, with the stars shining brilliantly. It was so cold that most of the invited guests were actually chilled. Making up the inner circle were Mrs. Houdini and Dr. Edward Saint, the Honorable Charles Fricke, a judge of the California High Courts, 2 newspapermen, a past president of the California Spiritualist Organization, a member of the American Institute of Psychic Research, Heward Carrington, and 2 magicians. One of the magicians was Carol Fleming, then president of the Pacific Coast Association of Magicians, and the other was a publisher of a magazine devoted to the concerns of the conjurers, William W. Larson, Sr. On a table in front of Mrs. Houdini and Dr. Saint was a small altar bearing a picture of Houdini. Over the table, a tiny light which had burned for 10 years. On a low stand in the center of the inner circle was a small table. On it was located a pistol, loaded with blank cartridges, a tambourine, a locked pair of handcuffs, which had never been unlocked since Houdini's death, a slate, a bit of chalk, a large bell, and a trumpet. In addition to manifesting himself to Mrs. Houdini via the secret code, Harry Houdini's spirit was to be prevailed upon to shoot the gun, unlock the cuffs, talk through the trumpet, and so on through the list of objects. Such were the proposed tests. Now, it seems that Dr. DiGiulini, a well-known West Coast mystery worker, and a few other outstanding magicians didn't really believe that anything was going to happen. They feared that the invited guests and the waiting world were doomed to bitter disappointment and possible disillusionment. So they offered their services to help better matters. It would be excellent, they told Dr. Saint, to get Houdini's handwriting on the slate, and they could assure its appearance there, or to cause a dove to fly up from the center of the table, seemingly created out of nothing. Dr. Saint wisely refused these generous offers. The seance was to be conducted on a strictly legitimate basis. The tricks of the conjurers were taboo. Promptly at 8 o'clock began the regal music of pomp and circumstance. This was the last music that Houdini ever used. He had always opened and closed his act with this music. Here is the actual voice of Dr. Edward Saint, recorded during the seance on that memorable night, October 31st, 1936.
Ladies and gentlemen, in this cathedral-like atmosphere tonight, I wish to remind you that this is a most solemn occasion for the close friends that have gathered here, that the zero hour of the 10th anniversary of our departed friend is fast nearing the end, and that the results of tonight are primarily of a personal and private nature only. No attempt is being made to sway the world or to convince the skeptics one way or the other. This is a personal gathering aiding Mrs. Houdini in completing her 10-year vigil and to aid Mrs. Houdini and ourselves to a final and logical conclusion. Nor is it expected or intended that others must necessarily agree. But this last personal attempt to contact the spirit of Houdini has aroused interest throughout the world, and to that extent will the findings here tonight be publicly recorded. We wish it distinctly understood that in this last and final attempt, we are interested in Houdini coming to us instead of to a stranger. Should Houdini contact a stranger anywhere in the world tonight, we know that Houdini will leave proper identification. On behalf of Mrs. Harry Houdini, I wish to thank all members of the press, both local and worldwide, the various national magazines, and the hundreds of individuals throughout the world that have aided. I wish to thank the sincere friends in the four corners of the United States, Canada, and Europe in the forming of some 20 or more simultaneous seances coinciding with our final attempt here in Hollywood. I wish to thank the several hundred friends, trained observers, and several dozen renowned psychics and mediums that are present with us here tonight, and especially the past president of the California State Spiritualist Association present here tonight, whose kindly advice has been of great value. Every facility has been provided tonight that might aid in opening a pathway to the spirit world. Here in the inner circle reposes a medium's trumpet, a pair of slates with chalk, a writing tablet and pencil, a small bell, and in the center reposes a huge pair of silver handcuffs on a silk cushion. Facing the inner circle stands the famous Houdini shrine with its doors ajar. The world knows that the Houdinis were always open-minded regarding spirit communication. Houdini sought to communicate with his beloved mother after she passed on, but he found no evidence that he could rely upon. The Houdinis always believed that in their search, if you remove the fraud, what is left must be the truth. And they together were always seekers after truth. Before Houdini's death, the Houdinis made a compact that the first to go would try to contact the survivor. Houdini had promised to deliver a message in code to his wife, also to open the silver handcuffs and other signs if he should pass over first. It so happens that Mrs. Houdini survives, and she made it a sacred duty to carry out the terms of the compact. The first year found Mrs. Houdini every Sunday between the hours of 12 noon and 2 o'clock, locked up in the privacy of her own room, seated in front of Houdini's photograph, waiting for some sign of Houdini as prearranged in the compact. The truth regarding spirit communication was to Harry and Bessie Houdini a very sincere and profound question. During the following years, each anniversary of his death has been devoted to Houdini. During the last 10 years, there have been times that Mrs. Houdini felt that surely Houdini was coming through, that her hopes of communication would be fulfilled. She was willing to believe, but the evidence did not stand up. At no time has Mrs. Houdini ever received a psychic communication from Houdini, nor has anything occurred anywhere in the world that would lead Mrs. Houdini to believe that Houdini was trying to come through. Yet hundreds of alleged psychics and mediums have written in and stated that Houdini has appeared to them in some form or other. In Chicago, they said he walked boldly into a room. In Kansas City, Houdini was said to have written a long letter to Mrs. Houdini. In Long Beach, Houdini was said to have hypnotized the medium and then delivered a message through her. In New Zealand, he drank a cup of tea. And in Santa Monica, he escaped from several pair of handcuffs by dematerializing his hands. These things may be. Surely it is not for Mrs. Houdini to decide. But we all believe, and many prominent psychics agree, that if Houdini has appeared all over the world in spirit form, under every kind of manifestation, and doing this many times every week of every year of the last 10 years, then we believe that the great Houdini will, on this last authentic seance, come to the little silver-haired widow, the little lady who for 33 years stood by the side of her beloved Harry, listening to the applause of kings and emperors and the world at large. A few days before his death in Detroit, Houdini, in a most strong and firm reminder, again said, "Bess, darling, I'll come back to you if it is possible, even if I have to go through hell to do it." That was Houdini talking. Houdini was an editor of the old New York World. He was an honorary lieutenant of police and instructed a class of detectives and officers of the police force regularly in New York City. He was the author of many books, a writer of many magazine articles, a publisher of a national magazine, head of many magical organizations throughout the world, including societies in Berlin, London, and New York City, member of the exclusive Circumnavigators Club, the Masons, the Elks, and many others. He headed investigating committees that led him to appear on the floor of Congress at Washington, D.C. The Houdinis, Harry and Bessie, presented remarkable magic acts in the palaces of Europe and throughout the world. Houdini was working in secret with Thomas A. Edison on a delicate psychic detecting instrument and a process that would permit him to take flashlight photographs in the dark without the flash being visible. 1,000 interests had Houdini besides his search and collecting of rare first editions to make his library on magic and occultism the largest private collection in the world, which led to the creating of the Houdini Room in the Congressional Library in Washington, D.C. today. Houdini spent much time in aeronautics, wrote authoritatively on the subject, and was one of the first 17 flyers of the world, owned his own plane, and was the first man to ever successfully fly an aeroplane in Australia, winning the Aerial Trophy in Melbourne, Australia, March 15, 1910. That, in brief, was the man, Houdini. He had safes and vaults in his home and vaults at banks that his lawyers had access to. But one secret now made public for the first time is the fact that Houdini had one safe deposit vault in a bank or trust company in the East under some family name other than Houdini, and of which the secret location rested only in Houdini's brain. In this vault was kept highly secret papers, and into which was always placed a certain glass case of jeweled metals and a diamond question mark pin with a rare pearl drop, a gift from Harry Keller to Houdini. The jewel box was always on display in the Houdini home, but prior to closing the house to go on a vaudeville tour, Houdini always placed this box in the secret vault. Many things were left untold because of the unexpected death of Houdini in Detroit. There is a law, a time limit. Madame Houdini has year by year awaited word that the federal government had located or opened the box long overdue. Perhaps the vault rent had been paid years in advance. However, this secret vault has never been located to this day. No medium or psychic has ever brought forth information from Houdini or the spirit world touching on or leading to its discovery. So if any circle tonight in any city or town in the world believes they are contacting Houdini, let them identify themselves by bringing forth this information regarding the secret vault. Tonight, we are in the very heart of glamorous Hollywood that Houdini loved so well. He lived here. He worked here. Houdini loved Hollywood. And Harry and Betsy Houdini celebrated their 25th, their silver wedding anniversary here. And all the great of Hollywood were present. And Houdini made a speech and said, "You are all invited now to be at our 50th, our golden wedding ceremony." And Will Rogers got up and gave an impersonation and said, "Houdini, I'll be here, but this is the way I'll be coming in." And he walked like an aged old man with a cane. Will Rogers is gone. Houdini is gone. Nearly two-thirds of that famous gathering is gone. But this is the kind of a night they all would have loved. Nothing could have kept them away. It's a Houdini night with the spotlight of the public on Houdini, with the whole world paused to see or hear Houdini step on this side of the curtain.
Now let us bow our heads in meditation and prayer. Oh, thou master mind of the universe, please let the spirit of understanding descend upon us that are gathered here in the inner circle tonight. We are each in his own way seekers after truth. Please let thy spirit of understanding guide us and bring the light of truth to the many friends that have earnestly formed psychic circles and gatherings throughout the entire world. Aid us, guide us on this most important question to mankind, spirit communication from across the grave. We ask this universal understanding in all humbleness, and we offer our grateful thanks to thee. Guide us, please. Amen. O thou disembodied spirits, those of you that have grown old in the mysterious laws of spirit land, we greet thee. We have gathered here at the appointed time. We have complied with all the requirements to enable all of you to make your presence known. Members of the spirit world have long known of the intention of this important gathering tonight. All is in readiness. Please now, the time is at hand. Make yourself known to us. Any of you, please. Manifest yourself in any way possible. Please let your united strength and knowledge aid Houdini in coming through. It is the spirit of Houdini we wish to contact. Houdini, are you here? Are you here, Houdini? Please manifest yourself in any way possible. Take from this earnest gathering any strength that may be necessary for you to use. Take any vital thing from us that you may need to enable you to carry out your promise of years ago. We have waited, Houdini, oh, so long. Never have you been able to present the evidence you promised. And now, this is a night of nights. The world is listening. Harry, your world, your audience. And Bessie is here. Your Bessie, who was part of you for 33 years. She's here, Harry, pleading in her heart for a prearranged sign from you. It means so much to her, to all of us, to the world. Harry, we are all seekers after truth. Please manifest yourself by speaking through the trumpet. Lift it. Lift it. Speak through it. Speak. Speak, Harry. We are watching and waiting, Harry. Levitate the table. Move it. Lift the table. Move it. Rap on it. Spell out a code, Harry. Please. Ring the bell. Let its tinkle be heard around the world. Do it, Harry. Please. Please, Houdini. We are waiting. Bessie is waiting. Oh, thou spirit. Your religion is based on love. And by that very token, a love of 33 years that have even entered into eternity, by that love I ask that you come through with the evidence. By the love of the little silver-haired widow, by the love and esteem of the countless friends, the evidence, Harry, and Houdini. Houdini, Dash, Dash is listening in. Dash, Hardeen, your brother has joined us with a circle. He is formed in New York City, 3,000 miles away. He has joined with us to seek the truth. And the circle in Baltimore, Philadelphia is listening in. In Providence, in Chicago, Leonard, who was once a protege of yours. A circle in Portland, Maine, and in the faithful city of Detroit, in Victoria, Canada, Tacoma, Rockford, Oakland and San Francisco, all over the world, all joining in. Come through, Harry. And Houdini, Colonel Harry Day, member of the British Parliament, has formed a circle in London, England. Colonel Day was your closest boyhood friend. Houdini, you must come through. And at the bottom of the world, Australia, the country where you made history, has joined in. We are crying to high heaven, to the powers that be. We are crying in one mighty magnetic voice from every corner of the earth, and the hearts and minds of the multitudes are centered here tonight. We want the evidence, the truth, in the name of humanity and love. If there is communication from the great beyond, come through with the evidence.
Then followed calm and silent meditation, and again a tense and dramatic soul pleading, in which Mrs. Houdini joined Dr. Saint. But no sign from Houdini. At last Dr. Saint, in a voice that broke and filled with emotion, asked,
Mrs. Houdini, the 0 hour has passed. The 10 years are up. Have you reached a decision?
Yes. Houdini did not come through. My last hope is gone. I do not believe that Houdini can come back to me or to anyone. After faithfully following through the 10-year Houdini compact, using every type, medium, and seance, it is now my personal and positive belief that spirit communication in any form is impossible. I do not believe that ghosts or spirits exist. The Houdini shrine has burned for 10 years. I now reverently turn out the light. It is finished. Good night, Harry.
Beatrice Houdini turned, and with Dr. Saint left the roof and stepped inside while the others waited respectfully at a distance. Then suddenly a long, low, distant rumble of thunder was heard. It began to rain. Now remember, those skies had been clear but a few moments before. It rained just long enough to wet everyone on the roof of the Hollywood Knickerbocker Hotel. And then it stopped and didn't rain again all evening.
The Houdini Seance, on Tuned to Yesterday. The original recordings were captured on October 31st, 1936. And that brings to a close this hour of True History, on Tuned to Yesterday. Be sure to be with us next time for more great shows from radio's past. Until our next hour together, I'm Mark Levonier. It's been a pleasure.